You're listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped. Welcome to the reading of the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for September 10th. I'm Kylie Kaler from Drake University, and here's our first story. The headline reads, AAUW Seeks to Empower Middle and High School Girls, by Tim Johnson. The American Association of University Women, Lewis Hills Branch, is sponsoring a Girl Power on Display Forum Saturday to empower middle and high school girls. Registration will begin at 9:30 a.m., followed by the forum at 10 a.m. at River Edge Pavilion, 4250 Rivers Edge Parkway in Council Bluffs. Women who have succeeded in different fields will share their stories with the girls, said Vergari Stanford, adjunct professor at the University of Nebraska-Omaha and coordinator of the event for AAUW. Quote, we want to expose them to these different avenues, end quote, she said. Quote, we want to inspire them to dream big, to go for their dreams, end quote. Another quote reads, we believe something like this is sorely needed, end quote, President Ann Kerr said. Iowa West Foundation guest speakers will include Ejane Hume of Lifegate Church, who does the Young, Loved, and Worthy podcast, Dr. Teresa Barron McKegney, University of Nebraska-Omaha professor and associate dean, Miranda Adams, co-founder of Blair Freedom Group Construction and Real Estate, and Sophia Sandoval, who does family support and adult education at Centro Latino of Iowa. The event will also include relaxation activities and question-answer sessions. Sanford was the driving force behind the event, Kerr said. Quote, we invited her to speak to our group in December, she said. She shared her story with us. She talked about mentoring girls. She had a dream that she'd like to do a forum with girls of color. And in January, Sanford joined the AAUW. Sanford grew up in Council Bluffs and had a dream since she was a little girl to get a PhD, Kerr said. Quote, she met a black woman who had a PhD and it inspired her to want to pursue her dream, end quote, Kerr said. Sanford earned a bachelor's degree in education at Buena Vista University, a master's degree at Bellevue University, and a PhD at Oral Roberts University before becoming an adjunct professor at UNO. Now she wants other girls to meet women of color who are successful. Quote, we are gearing it towards girls of color, but it is for all girls, she said. AAUW members have contacted all of the school districts in Pottawatomie County and talked to school counselors, besides distributing flyers, Kerr said. However, they did not require pre-registration for the event, so they're not sure what to expect. Frankly, we don't know how many people are going to come, she said. They know there will be people there from Children's Square USA, Sanford said. This is a first step, Kerr said. If this works, we want to do this again every year. There is no fee to attend, door prizes will be given away, and each girl will receive a goodie bag. That is a pretty neat program. The next article reads, Volunteers Begin Observance of Iowa 99 County Bible Reading Marathon, by Tim Johnson. Bible readers gathered in front of the historic Pottawatomie County Squirrel Cage Jail Thursday to begin Pottawatomie County's observance of the Iowa 99 County Bible Reading Marathon. The sixth annual public Bible reading started at 9 a.m. Thursday and will continue from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. today and Saturday. It is being held in a grassy area on the north side of the courthouse grounds in front of the historic Pottawatomie County Squirrel Cage Jail at 226 Pearl Street. In a proclamation issued on June 15th, Governor Kim Reynolds designated June 27th through July 3rd and or September 4th through 10th as the dates for the Bible reading marathon. However, participating counties tend to pick their own dates and times. On Thursday afternoon, coordinator Greg Barnstein and his wife Pamela and another adult were concentrating on the New Testament, he said. Each was reading a different book of the New Testament so that they could cover more ground. Quote, we're trying to at least read the New Testament, he said. Some are reading the Old Testament. I don't know if we can finish that. There are a lot of books there. This morning, we had two other adults, he said. Now we've got 5 adults and some kids. The weather was favorable. No rain is expected during the marathon. Another quote reads, "Another good year for Bible reading," Barnstein said. He noted that it could get hot today and Saturday, but he said he had a cooler containing cold water. End quote. Courtney Williams of Council Bluffs was there with 4 of her 6 children, Malachi, age 10, Mariah, age 9, Molly, age 6, and Maggie, age 4. Her oldest daughters, Madeline, 16, and Marianne, 13, were there earlier in the day, she said. Her husband, Ken, reads when he doesn't have to work. The family members present were sitting around and taking turns reading the book of Titus, she said. Quote, "I like to do it together so the little ones can listen," she said, although she was glad Malachi read on his own when the others were taking a break. It's the 5th year Williams and her family have participated in the event, Williams said. She loves this, she said. It's one of her favorite family events and activities. Tanya Ratcliffe of Crescent was there with her children, Elijah, age 12, Aaliyah, age 9, Isaiah, age 4. They formed their own group and took turns reading. On Thursday afternoon, they read the book of Esther at the request of the children. Quote, they thought that would be a fun one to read, she said. There's some really interesting things that happen. End quote. Her son Elijah offered a quick summary of Esther. She becomes queen. Haman wants to kill her, which is her cousin. Mordechai, the king of Persia, her husband, says all Jews will be killed. Haman kind of tricked the king in proclaiming that, he said. Then Esther saves all her people. Said Barnstein, "I find it very encouraging that some of these mothers will bring their children and read with them, set a good example." End quote. Those interested in reading can sign up for a time slot online at bit.ly/2x5ycbw, or just come whenever you are able, Barnstein said. Quote, "They can sign up online if they want, or they can just show up," he said. "My wife and I are going to be there most of the time." There's a picture there of Greg Barnstein, coordinator of Pottawatomie County Observance of Iowa 99 County Bible Reading Marathon, and he's reading the New Testament Thursday afternoon in front of the Squirrel Cage Jail. He seems to be reading the Bible with his head kind of turned down. He's wearing a hat and glasses, and he seems to be looking very pleasant. There's also a photo of his wife, Pamela, and she is also reading the Gospel of John during the observance. And she also looks very pleasant, wearing a blazer and some sunglasses. It seems to be sunny outside. Democrats Push Civilian Climate Corps by Matthew Daly. Inspired by the New Deal era Civilization Conservation Corps, President Joe Biden and congressional Democrats are pushing for a modern counterpart, a civilian climate corps that would create hundreds of thousands of jobs, building trails, restoring streams, and helping to prevent catastrophic wildfires. But building on Biden's oft-repeated comment that when he thinks of climate change, he thinks of jobs. The White House says that $10 billion program would address both priorities as young adults find work installing solar panels, planting trees, digging irrigation ditches, boosting outdoor recreation. Quote, "We must seize this opportunity to build a big, bold pathway to critical careers for a diverse generation of Americans ready to take on this existential crisis that we face," end quote, said Ali Zayadi, Deputy White House Climate Advisor. Quote, "It's a national service meets family-supporting careers meets the moment," end quote. The effort comes as the White House and many Democrats are intensifying their focus on climate change after a series of devastating storms recently battered much of the nation. Touring neighborhoods in New York and New Jersey this week that were devastated by flooding from remnants of Hurricane Ida. Biden said climate change has become everybody's crisis. "The threat is here. It's not getting any better," Biden said. "The question is, can it get worse?" The proposed climate corps was not included in a bipartisan infrastructure bill approved by the Senate, but it is a key part of an emerging $3.5 trillion package backed by the Democrats to help families and address climate change. A vote in the House on both bills could occur by the end of the month. Representative Joe Neguse, a Colorado Democrat who has co-sponsored a climate corps bill, said It's important to train the next generation of U.S. land managers, park rangers, and other stewards of our natural resources. See, this bold investment is a necessary response to the climate crisis and priorities the maintenance and upkeep of public lands, he said. While the job should pay at least $15 an hour, those likely to join the Climate Corps are not doing it for the compensation, Nagus said. They know it's important to connect to nature and do important work for their state and the nation. Details are still being worked out, but Nagus and other Democrats say that programs should pay a living wage while offering health care coverage and support for child care, housing, transportation, and education. David Popp, a professor at public administration at Syracuse University, said a key distinction between the original Civilization Conservation Corps and the new climate change contingent is that the U.S. economy is not in a depression, great or otherwise, as it was during the Franklin D. Roosevelt's presidency. While U.S. employers added just about 235,000 jobs in August, the unemployment rate decreased slightly to 5.2% as the economy continues to recover from the coronavirus pandemic. Most of those being targeted for the new Climate Corps could find employment elsewhere, Pop said, noting a proliferation of help-wanted signs at retail businesses across the nation. Quote, I don't know that an unemployed coal worker in West Virginia is going to move to Montana to take a minimum wage job to restore streams, quote, he said. On the other hand, some of his own students are highly motivated by the climate crisis and may want to spend a year or two on an outdoor job that helps address an existential threat to the planet, Pop said. Quote, many young people are very passionate about the environment, and they may see this as an opportunity to do something about the environment and still get paid for it, he said. End quote. Republicans largely dismiss the Climate Corps as a do-gooder proposal that would waste money and could even take away jobs from workers displaced by the pandemic and push for so-called green jobs. Quote, my grandfather worked for the CCC, and I remember him telling me how terrible it was, how backbreaking the work was, end quote, said Arkansas Representative Bruce Westerman, the top Republican on the House Natural Resources Committee. Quote, we don't need another FDR program, and an idea that this is going to help land management is a false idea as well, end quote, Westerman said. At a committee meeting last week, Representative Cliff Bentz, Republican of Oregon, called the proposed Climate Corps delusional, adding, why would we think people are going to suddenly jump at doing really, really hard, dirty, dangerous work because we offered them $15 an hour? That's not going to happen. Senator Ed Markey, Democrat of Massachusetts, a prominent supporter of the Climate Corps, said the criticism overlooks the important benefits. The program could help communities recover from climate disasters such as Hurricane Ida, Western wildfires, while creating good-paying jobs that could turn into a clean economy careers, Markey said. In the process, the Climate Corps will make the country a safer, healthier place that can compete in the global economy, he said. The urgency of the climate crisis recalls past chapters of national mobilization, Regius said. In standing up for the civilian Climate Corps, he would build on the legacy and existing infrastructure to meet the challenges of today. And this is the end of the article. The next headline reads, Vilsack Addresses Renewable Fuels Industry's Concerns by Aaron Murphy. Federal Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack on Thursday responded to concerns expressed by some in the renewable fuels and biofuels industry who believe President Joe Biden's administration is placing more of an emphasis on electrical vehicles and less on renewable fuels like ethanol and biodiesel. Vilsack, the Federal Agriculture Secretary and former Iowa governor, addressed this issue during a conference call to announce federal funding for renewable energy and energy efficiency projects. Quote, you look at the totality of it all, and you look at the investment, for example, today, and you can see that there's a wide range of ways that this administration to provide and assistance to the biofuel industry, end quote, Vilsack said. Monty Shaw, executive director of the Iowa Renewable Fuels Association, expressed the concern recently during a roundtable discussion on rural issues with Congresswoman Sidney Axne of Central Iowa and Sherry Bustis of Northwest Illinois. Biden last month set the goal that by 2030, half of all new vehicles sold will be electric. Vilsack, during Thursday's call, defended the administration's dedication to renewable and biofuels. He noted, for example, that the administration has pledged to limit the number of waivers that allow large oil refineries to avoid the full impact of the federal mandate that a certain percentage of the national fuel supply contain corn-based ethanol. Quote, I think folks need to be a bit patient, need to be understanding, and we need to look more deeply at how the administration supports renewable and biofuels, end quote, Vilsack said. The subheading reads, Five Iowa Projects Funded. Five Iowa projects will receive federal grants totaling more than $86,000 from a federal program to boost renewable energy and energy efficiency projects, Vilsack announced during Thursday's call. Vilsack said the projects, which total $434 million in federal investment across the country, represents a federal investment in climate-smart infrastructure that he said will drive down energy costs for rural farms and small businesses, support jobs, and spur economic development. The Iowa projects were awarded grants under the department's Rural Energy for America program, or REAP. Quote, these REAP programs can consist of solar panels on farms. They can consist of windmills that provide power, Vilsack said. And during the call, on some cases, they involve energy efficiency and an opportunity to basically take a look at ways in which the farm can save energy. Smart technologies and smart energy efficiency facilities can also save money. The five Iowa projects that received federal grants are, according to the Ag Department, one, a $20,000 grant for Lauren Dempster and Garnavello to purchase and install a 101-kilowatt solar array. The second one is a $15,321 for Slumberland Furniture to purchase and install LED light fixtures. The third project is a $19,200 for Grundy County Rural Electric Cooperative to purchase and install LED lighting throughout the co-op's service area. The fourth project is an $11,615 project to Michael Martin. Location is not listed, but to help purchase and install a 34-kilowatt solar array. And then the fifth project, a $20,000 project to Wooden Wheel Vineyards in Kyoto to help purchase and install a 50-kilowatt solar array. And Vilsack said that all of the projects that received grants and loans were chosen based on a criteria and ranking system employed by REAP. So then there's a photo of the U.S. Secretary of Agriculture, Tom Vilsack, at a podium speaking inside Rustic Cuts in Council Bluffs on Friday, July 9th, 2021. And this photo was taken by Joe Shearer. And he is, like I said, speaking at a podium wearing a suit. And he also has multiple people from the Association of Agriculture standing behind him wearing polos. And it looks like there's several cases of meat as well at their location of Rustic Cuts. There's another photo also on the front page of the newspaper of Representative Sidney Axne and Tom Vilsack standing in front or behind a deli meat counter with several steaks, hamburgers, other types of meat in the case. And they are with the cone owners of Rustic Cuts, Jake Driver and Rick Larson. The face of the day is brought to us by Gary Apple. And the face of the day is Sydney Cullen, and she is someone who has an exciting future ahead of her, but she is living in the moment right now. She's 17 and was born and raised in Council Bluffs. She's been a student in the Council Bluffs Community School District for all of her education. She started at Hoover Elementary School and then Kern Middle School, making her way to Abraham Lincoln High School, where she is starting her senior year, and said that it is very hard to believe how quickly time has flown through her high school career. Quote, talking with the upperclassmen, they tell you how fast things go by and it's hard to believe them, end quote, she said, despite how fast it's gone. By Colin said her high school experience has been great so far, and she's involved outside of the classroom and has made many friends. Those in her class and many older and younger than her said, she said, it's been great meeting a diverse group of people while growing up. Colin developed a love for journalism as a freshman when she took an introductory class and immediately fell in love. She joined the yearbook staff later that year, and she's been on staff ever since. She's the co-editor-in-chief this year, and the skills she's picked up over the years will help her guide her staff as they document the lives of the Link student body this year. Colin is a natural performer, and she loves taking the stage. She's been dancing since she could walk, and she's currently training at Motion Works Dance Studio in Council Bluffs. She is also a member of AL's show choir, which she has been a part of since freshman year. She said, competitions don't start until the winter, but the team's already practicing their songs and choreography for the season, and Colin will take these passions as she heads off to college next fall. She'll be attending the University of South Dakota, where she'll study media journalism and musical theater. She said her dream is to work on the stage someday. I'm a performer, she said. While the future has her excited for what's ahead, Colin said she wants to savor her final semester at AL. She is looking forward to sporting events, dances, and all of the other Cornerstone High School experiences. Quote, it's going to fly by quicker than I think, she said. Live in the present. That's what I'm going to do. End quote. It sounds like Sydney certainly has a bright future ahead of her. You're listening to the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for September 10th on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped in Des Moines. I am Kylie from Drake University. IRIS volunteers love to hear from listeners. If you have any comments or questions about this or any other IRIS program, please call toll-free from anywhere in Iowa at 877-404-4747. The next article headline reads, Are We Forgetting the Central Lesson of 9/11? By Stephen Groves, the Heritage Foundation. The article starts, How should one best observe the anniversary of the horrific terrorist attack of September 11, 2001? These annual commemorations have always been momentous and solemn occasions, and the attention of the American people is where it deserves to be. On the men, women, and children who needlessly died that day. It is right and proper that our focus should be first and foremost on the tragic loss of those lives. It is also right and proper that we should reflect on the lessons of 9/11 and how it came to pass that more than 2,600 Americans were killed over the course of a few hours that day. Even more importantly, we should ask ourselves whether the United States has learned the lessons of 9/11 and whether our government lived up to the commitment that encapsulates the post-9/11 admonition of the American people, quote, never forget. But it seems that our government may have forgotten the central lesson of 9/11 that loosely governed lands over which the U.S. has little or no intelligence visibility, create the permissive environment most attractive to terrorist organizations that desire to strike America. The collapse of Afghanistan to the arms of the Taliban has once again set the stage for that nation to host terrorist groups that target the West. Already, there have been reports that the Taliban's return has inspired and boosted the morale of militants in Southeast Asia, some of whom plan to travel to Afghanistan for training. It may be that in no time Al-Qaeda reconstitutes itself and harbored by the Taliban once again becomes a threat to America and its allies. The Islamic State and other terrorist organizations may also seek sanctuary in Afghanistan. The U.S. intelligence community has long believed that it would take up to 2 years after a U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan before a reconstituted Al-Qaeda could pose a threat to America. Of course, the American people are right to be skeptical of such assessments, given that President Joe Biden recently predicted it would be highly unlikely that the Taliban would overrun Afghanistan and own the whole country. The Biden administration has given assurances to the American people that its botched withdrawal from Afghanistan would not result in a repeat of the past. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken recently informed us that the Taliban, quote, has made a commitment to prevent terrorist groups from using Afghanistan as a base for external operations and could threaten the United States or our allies, including Al-Qaeda and the Taliban's worst enemy, ISIS, end quote. Perhaps President Biden and Secretary Blinken actually trust the Taliban, as ridiculous as that may seem, but the American people are far less sanguine about promises made by militant Islamists who enforce a brutal fundamentalist version of Sharia law. Blinken also assures us that the U.S. will remain vigilant in monitoring threats ourselves and will maintain robust counterterrorism capabilities in the region to neutralize those threats. But Americans are right to be concerned, and vigilance and supposed regional capabilities are sufficient to protect the homeland in the absence of the U.S. embassy, a CIA base of operations, and diminished surveillance capacity in the mountains and valleys of Afghanistan. In the days following 9/11, President George W. Bush presented a series of ultimatums to the Taliban: deliver the leaders of Al-Qaeda to America, close every terrorist camp, release all foreign nationals who have been unjustly imprisoned. Today, the Taliban are back in control. Al-Qaeda is set for a resurgence, and Americans and other foreign nationals are stranded. It remains unclear what lessons the Biden administration has learned, if any. It's up to President Biden to ensure the security of Americans for the next few years and to, quote, never forget what happened 20 years ago. Based on his track record, however, we are in for a dangerous 3 years. There's also a image that goes along with this article, and it is an image of fires burning amidst the rubble of the World Trade Center on September 13, 2001, days after the September 11, 2001 terrorist attack. So there's a lot of rubble, a lot of building debris and smoke that is rising up into the photo. It's pretty horrific as there's blue skies behind the buildings. So it seems as to be a beautiful day of what is a horrific image. This is also an opinion article for the day. The next opinion article for the day, headline reads, "Nonprofits have the power to create a more inclusive democracy," and this is by Brian Miller, on behalf of the Fulcrum. So our democracy is a chorus, one that only improves when more and diverse voices join, adding richness to the sound. Despite the volume of last year's election, one that broke a century-old record for voter turnout, there were nonetheless missing in underrepresented voices. Those gaps in turnout are even more pronounced in the local election cycles like 2021, resulting in an older, whiter electorate. So how do we achieve a truly representative electorate? Voter-friendly policies are important, but they are not enough by themselves. Yes, everyone can have a right to a music stand and a songbook, but who is conducting the auditions? In the end, voter turnout is largely a reflection of who is contacted about voting and who is not. Political parties and campaigns have failed to close voter participation gaps because that's not their goal. Their goal is to win an election, not foster an inclusive electorate, but the most well-meaning campaigns have to prioritize their resources on, quote, likely voters. The experienced singers who performed last time, the uninvited singers, don't show, and the cycle repeats itself. So, who has the capacity and motivation to expand the invite list and create the truly diverse and representative chorus of voices? One key to that question is America's nonprofits, from food pantries to housing clinics, which are motivated by broader values of inclusivity and ensuring the communities they serve are heard. And in the newly released Nonprofit Power Report, which details our work with 180 nonprofits across 7 states in 2020, shows that nonprofits that marry voter engagement with their mission can help foster a more inclusive and representative democracy. It also provides a roadmap for nonprofit organizations eager to ensure our country lives up to its promise as a diverse chorus of citizenry. The report explores nonprofit reach and impact on turnout, among other things. Let's start with whom nonprofits reach. Nonprofits typically offer their services to the very communities that are most underrepresented in our democracy, so it only makes sense that when those same organizations do voter engagement work, they are engaging a part of the electorate most often left out of the national conversation. In fact, the report shows that voters engaged by nonprofits in our program were more than twice as likely to be voters of color, more than twice as likely to earn less than $30,000 annually, and nearly twice as likely to be young, therefore ages 18 to 24. So often described as, quote, low propensity voters, these groups are rarely contacted by political campaigns. They represent the choral singers, who don't get invited. Without that contact, they don't show up to the polls, and the next election sees candidates once again not engaging them, completing the vicious cycle of exclusion. As trusted actors with a vested interest in uplifting the communities they serve, nonprofits can sow the seeds of real inclusive political participation. Where campaigns see low propensity voters, nonprofits see high potential voters, hungry for genuine engagement and respect. The COVID-19 pandemic also provided a learning opportunity as many nonprofits pivoted to online and digital strategies, while others continued in-person engagement with social distancing and PPEs. The organizations that did COVID-safe in-person engagement were 1.7 times more likely to reach low-income voters and 1.4 times more likely to reach voters of color than those who relied on digital strategies. But reaching voters is just the first step in ensuring our democracy lives up to its promise. What impact do nonprofits have in getting those newly engaged voters, some for the first time, to the polls? The Nonprofit Power Report shows that voters engaged by nonprofits have a turnout advantage over voters not contacted by nonprofits. Even in a highly saturated election year like 2020, voters engaged by nonprofits saw their turnout increase by 3% points. However, when we dialed into specific voter demographics, especially people of color, young voters, and low-income voters, the results were even more encouraging. Low-income voters saw a 7 percentage point increase. Asian American and Pacific Islander voters saw a 6 percentage point boost. Hispanic voters saw a 5 percentage point boost, and young voters saw a 5 percentage point boost. A nonprofit vote in all caps. We believe in this work because we believe in the power of nonprofits. Whether that's through hands-on training, our webinar series, robust resource library, or research, we know that organizations genuinely embedded in their communities can be a powerhouse for democracy. And that's why we encourage you to take a deep dive into the Nonprofit Power Report, including the Practitioner's Report, providing a roadmap for your organization. And in the end, there is no question that nonprofits that commit to voter engagement can have a positive impact on the communities that they serve, the nation at large. The only question is what role your organization will play to ensure our democracy is still a song for all, by all. We will now move to the obituary section of the newspaper. The first obituary is for Joyce S. Baker, age 69, passed away at her residence on September 8, 2021. Joyce was born on May 31, 1952, in Omaha, Nebraska, to the late Clinton and Wanda McDonald. She was united in marriage to Guy Baker and have spent the last 49 years together. Joyce loved to craft and tend to her rose garden and loved her family and grandchildren. Joyce is preceded in death by her parents, 3 siblings, and she is survived by her husband Guy, son John, wife Michelle Baker, daughter Heather, spouse Juan Martinez, son Josh, spouse Kelly Baker, grandchildren Jalia, McKenna, and Erica, Christopher, Denny, and Sybil, sister Lydia Torres, brothers Danny and Eddie and Randy McDonald, and the visitation will be held Sunday from 2 to 4 p.m. The funeral service will be Monday at 11 a.m., all at the funeral home, and masks are encouraged for the funeral visitation and funeral service. The funeral home is Cutler O'Neill, 545 Willow Avenue, Council Bluffs. The next obituary article reads, former U.S. Senator Adlai Stevenson III, 90, dead from dementia. Former U.S. Senator Stevenson III of Illinois has died at his home on Chicago's north side. He was 90. His son, Adlai Stevenson IV, who confirmed the Illinois Democrat died on Monday, said his father had dementia. Before his health declined, Stevenson kept active organizing presentations and speakers for the Adlai Stevenson Center on Democracy in Libertyville, Illinois. He also worked on the family farm in Hanover, Illinois, raising cattle, growing corn and hay for their feed, and chopping wood. Quote, he just faded away, his son said. Stevenson ran for governor of Illinois twice, losing his 1982 run by just 5,074 votes to Republican Governor Jim Thompson. It is the closest Illinois election for governor in modern state history. Stevenson was the great-grandson of former Vice President Adlai Stevenson, and his father, Adlai Stevenson II, was a former Illinois governor and two-time presidential candidate. When running for the Senate, where he was first elected in 1970 to serve out the remainder of the late Senator Everett Dirksen's term, Stevenson asked the Chicago mayor, Richard Daley, for advice. My advice to you is don't change your name, Daley told him, the Chicago Sun-Times reported. Stevenson was reelected in 1974, but decided not to run again in 1980. He stepped aside in January 1981 for fellow Democrat Alan Dixon, who won the November election. And Stevenson III graduated from Milton Academy, Harvard College, and Harvard Law School. He served with the Marine Corps in Korea and was discharged as a captain from the Marine Reserves in 1961. Stevenson is survived by his wife Nancy, his two sons Adlai IV and Warwick, two brothers John and Borden, and nine grandchildren. Information on services was not immediately available. The next obituary article reads, former Notre Dame football star Coach Brennan dies at 93. Terry Brennan, a star halfback on three unbeaten Notre Dame teams, who was hailed as a wonderkind when he was succeeded Irish coaching great Frank Lehigh at just 25 years old. He died. He was 93. The school announced his death Wednesday. Brennan died Tuesday, said the funeral home in Skokie, Illinois, handling the arrangements. He had lived in nearby Wilmette. Brennan led the Irish in receiving and scoring as they won back-to-back national championships in 1946, 8-1 and 9-0, and then went 9-1 and finished ranking number 2 in 1948. His teammates included Heisman Trophy winners John Lubeck, Lou Jack, and Leon Hart. As both a player and a coach, Brennan took part in games that rank among the best in Notre Dame history. And in 1946, Brennan made a key interception when the second-ranked Irish played to a 0-0 tie against number one Army at packed Yankee Stadium in a matchup dubbed the Game of the Century. Army drove to the Notre Dame 12, but Brennan picked off a pass at the 5. On the next play, he turned to Notre Dame's longest run of 22 yards. Quote, it turned out to be kind of a dull game of the century, he said in a 2010 interview. Both teams finished the season unbeaten and neither played in bowls. Notre Dame was voted number one in the final AP poll and Army finished number two. Quote, most of us were young guys and didn't realize how big it was until 10 or 20 years later, he said. Just over a decade later, he coached the Irish to a 7-0 victory over Oklahoma in 1957 and ended the Sooners' record 47-game winning streak. After his playing career ended, Brennan was drafted by the NFL, but instead chose to coach at Mount Carmel High School in Chicago while earning a law degree from DePaul University, and after leading Mount Carmel to city championships in 1951, 1952, and 1953, Brennan was hired to coach the freshman team at Notre Dame. A season later, Brennan was promoted to head coach in a move that shocked the college football world. Lehigh had won 4 national titles in 11 seasons at Notre Dame, but retired due to health concerns. And Brennan started strong, with Notre Dame finishing 9-1 and ranked number 4 in 1954 and 8-2 and number 9 a season later. But the Irish dropped to 2-8 in 1956, despite having the Heisman Trophy winning quarterback Paul Hurung, and were beaten 47-14 by Michigan State and 40-0 by Oklahoma in South Bend in what was the team's most lopsided loss at Notre Dame Stadium. As a result, the school's faculty board and control of athletics recommended Brennan be fired, but the Reverend Theodore Hesburgh, president of the university, decided to bring Brennan back. Notre Dame went 7-3 the next season, finishing number 10 and boosted by the big upset of Oklahoma. Brennan said in 2007 that when the Irish were blown out by Oklahoma in 1956, he took some chances that didn't work. He felt more confident of his team's abilities in 1957, so he called the game more conservatively, and the defense played particularly well. Quote, you never play a perfect game, but I don't think the guys made a lot of mistakes, he said. There were very few, if any, and that was the key, end quote. Brennan recalled the Oklahoma fans were shocked. The silence was deafening, he said. Brennan was fired after the Irish finished 6-4 in 1958, with the dismissal coming 4 days before Christmas. The move was criticized by many, not only because of its timing, but supporters said Brennan was taking the fall after the school cut on scholarships as it raised academic standards. Brennan finished with a record of 32-18, a .640 winning percentage, and he was succeeded by Joe Coleridge, another former Notre Dame player who posted a 17-23 record in 4 seasons. And that was the last time Brennan coached football. He served as a player conditioning coach for the Cincinnati Reds in 1959, spring training. He worked for years in banking and investment and lived in a suburban Chicago. Brennan was preceded in death by his wife, Kel. He is survived by 4 sons, 2 daughters, 25 grandchildren, and 32 great-grandchildren. The next article reads, Michael Constantine of My Big Fat Greek Wedding Dies at 94 by the Associated Press. Michael Constantine, an Emmy Award-winning character actor who reached worldwide fame playing the Windex bottle-toting father of the bride in the 2002 film My Big Fat Greek Wedding, has died. He was 94. Constantine died August 31st. At his home in Reading, Pennsylvania, of natural causes, his family said. The news was confirmed to the Associated Press on Thursday by his agent, Julia Buchwald. Constantine made appearances on such TV shows as My Favorite Martian, The Twilight Zone, Bonanza, Hogan's Heroes, The Dick Van Dyke Show, The Fugitive, Quincy and Me, The Love Boat, Remington Steele, MacGyver, and Murder, She Wrote. His big break came in the role of principal on Room 222, an ABC comedy drama set in a racially diverse Los Angeles high school, for which he won an Emmy for Outstanding Performance by an Actor in a Supporting Role in 1970. But he became best known for his work in the indie comedy My Big Fat Greek Wedding, which centered on a middle-class Greek-American woman who falls in love with an upper-class white Anglo-Saxon Protestant. Constantine reprised his role on the TV series My Big Fat Greek Wedding, My Big Fat Greek Life, and the 2016 film My Big Fat Greek Wedding 2. My Big Fat Greek Wedding became the highest-grossing romantic comedy of all time with a $241.4 million domestic gross income. It was based on writer star Nia Vardalos, one woman played and produced by Tom Hanks and Rita Wilson for just $5 million, and Constantine initially auditioned for the part of Gus and told The Hollywood Reporter that he was anxious to read Varlos's script, leery about how it might represent the American Greek experience. Quote, I was anxious about someone writing some Greek thing. Was it going to be baloney, or was it going to be something by somebody who really knows Greeks? So I read the script and I said, yes, this person obviously knows Greeks, he said. Vardalos paid tribute to Constantine on Twitter, writing, acting with him came with a rush of love and fun. I will treasure this man who brought Gus to life. He gave us so much laughter and deserves a rest now. Constantine was the son of Greek immigrants. He started his career on stage and was on Broadway in the late 1950s and early 60s in such shows as Arturo Uy, The Miracle Worker, and Inherit the Wind. He made his big screen debut alongside Mickey Rooney in The Last Mile and had roles in The Hustler, Don't Drink the Water, Prancer, The Reavers, My Life, and The Juror. Constantine was married and divorced twice. Survivors include his sisters Patricia Gordon and Chris Dobbs. There's a picture, then, of the cast members from left. Louis Mandler, Nia Vardalos, Lainey Kazan, and then Michael Constantine of the new CBS comedy series My Big Fat Greek Life, based on the hit film My Big Fat Greek Wedding. They were rehearsing a scene on the set in Los Angeles in February 14, 2003, and so this is what that scene is portraying. It's in the kitchen, and they all are talking to each other, And then we will read the next article. Cy-Hawk roots run deep for Shudak by Steve Batterson. Like father, like son, the jersey colors may differ, but Lewis Central graduate Caleb Shudak still finds himself living in the dream as he follows in his father's footsteps. Iowa's sixth-year senior place kicker is preparing to do whatever he can do to help the 10th-ranked Hawkeyes in Saturday's 3:30 p.m. Cy-Hawk matchup at 9th-ranked Iowa State, a place where Shudak's father starred in the same role a generation ago. "I grew up wanting to be like my dad," Caleb Shudak said. "He was my hero, and it has been a blessing to have him in my corner, always there supporting me and helping me." Jeff Shudak remains second on the Cyclones' all-time scoring list, connecting on 58 field goals, gold tries, and collecting 266 points as a four-year starter in the ISU lineup from 1987 to 1990. Caleb Shudak is in his third season of handling kickoff duties for the Hawkeyes and is in his first year as Iowa's primary place kicker, putting him in a position to make an impact in a series where kickers have traditionally been difference makers. Keith Duncan kicked four field goals for Iowa in the Hawkeyes' 18-17 victory at Jack Trice Stadium this last time the two teams met in 2019. So in Iowa State's last win in the series, Cole Netton kicked a game-winning 42-yard field goal with 2 seconds remaining in the Cyclones' 20-17 victory win at Kinnick Stadium in 2014. And so Brett Culbertson did the same against Hawkeyes in 2007, hitting from 28 yards with a second left on the clock to give ISU a 15-13 win. It's that type of challenge Shudak welcomes. Quote, "You work all year to be ready. When the situation comes up," he said, "I'm confident that whenever and wherever we find ourselves in that position, I'll be ready." That's genetics. Jeff Shudak never had an opportunity to attempt a game winner against Iowa, which was in the middle of a string of 15 straight victories over its in-state rival at the time. But he did hit his share of game winners. No kicker in ISU history has hit more game-deciding field goals in the final minute of a game than the three Shudak hit during his career. He beat Kansas State in 1987 and Missouri and Kansas during the 1990 season, a three-time first-team All-Big Eight selection. Jeff Shudak earned his first honor as a freshman in 1987 when he converted on 20 out of 25 field goal attempts. He found success as a soccer-style kicker who proved capable of coping with changes in the game at that time, including the NCAA's decision in 1989 to ban the use of small kicking tees on field goal and extra point tries. He dealt with a lot during his career, and we've talked about just being prepared to deal with whatever the game throws at you, Caleb Shudak said. Quote, "I think that helped prepare me for my career in college. An all-state kicker who also played running back, linebacker, and defensive back during his prep career at Lewis Central High School in Council Bluffs, Iowa. Shudak has needed patience throughout his career and in Iowa uniform. He joined the Hawkeyes as a walk-on in 2016 and immediately found himself competing with Duncan and Miguel Recisneros for playing time throughout the initial years of his career, before hitting field goals from 41 and 35 years and 4 Pat tries during Iowa's season opening 34-6 win over Indiana. Shudak's resume consisted of hitting one Pat attempt in a 2018 game Illinois and hitting an upright on a 52-yard field goal try last season in a loss to Northwestern. A four-time academic All-Big Ten selection as a civil and environmental engineering major, Shudak opted to return to Iowa for a sixth season, in part because of an opportunity he had to the start of his season. Quote, "In talking with my parents, they encouraged me to come back. You only get one chance to enjoy a college career, so why not take it? Why not make it last as long as it can," Shudak said. "I felt like last season was a chance for me to make the best of all the work I'd put into the game over time." Iowa coach Kirk Frentz has never doubted Shudak's abilities I've always said that we consider him, along with Keith Duncan, to be starters. He's an older guy who has always practiced well, Ferentz said. Sometimes you just have two guys that are really good. We had total confidence in him when he got his chance. The consistency and Shudak's work on kickoffs added to that confidence. That work also provided Shudak with opportunity to compete on the same field as his father 2 years ago, kicking off for Iowa in the most recent game at Jack Trice Stadium. This weekend, he hopes his leg can have an even greater impact on the outcome. Quote, Coach Matt Campbell has done good things with the program at Iowa State, and we know going over there this season that we're going to have play well as a team. Shudak said, we're going to have to play our best ball, and if it comes down to a kick, I plan to be ready to go. He knows Iowa State will always be part of his father and suspects it was tough for him at first to see his son in an Iowa uniform. Quote, I grew up watching Iowa State play. He always has been a diehard fan, but I think he's come around a bit. Seeing the type of experience I've had at Iowa and knowing how much I've enjoyed it here, Shudak said. And this week, the advice a father gave to his son prior to his last game against an in-state rival has been as consistent as his kicking. Just have fun. It's a game, and there's no need to stress, Shudak said. He's always telling me to just take it all in and enjoy it. The Reavers Overcome Adversity by Peter Hewinen. Change of plans at the last minute caused a lot of uncertainty for Iowa Western's women's soccer on Wednesday. The Reavers were originally slated to play Hawkeye Community College at home on Tuesday, but field conditions forced IWCC to move the game to Tuesday at Tranquility Park in Omaha. Not only did Iowa Western have to switch locations, but many players had academic requirements to also balance on Wednesday. None of that mattered come game time as the Reavers handled the Red Tails in a 3-0 victory to stay undefeated at 5-0. Quote, I thought they did really well, head coach Adam Sanchez said. It was a little difficult for us. The uncertainty of the fixture was tough to plan for. The girls just had a busy school day. There was a lot of stuff going on. Quote, I thought the girls, when they got there, were focused, and that was probably their best performance of the year so far. That was good to see, end quote. Sophomore Paula Boza opened the scoring in the 42nd minute to take a 1-0 lead into halftime. Sophomore Yoshaki Kidadi scored in the 51st minute on an assist from freshman Marie Quintel. The Reavers sealed the victory in the 59th minute when Quintel found sophomore Rurika Kimura. Quintel was relentless there in the midfield for us, Sanchez said, and I thought our outside backs did really well, Brenna Johnson and Jessica Slater stepping into the lineup. They found the spaces that Hawkeye was giving us. It helped our attack be more dynamic. Sydney Marlowe looked pretty comfortable back there in goal. Out-center backs of Barbara Russo and Roser Badia did really good job of settling us down. Iowa Western controlled the ball for most of the game, finishing with 21 shots. Hawkeye only recorded 3 shots. IWCC ended with 11 corner kicks. The Reavers are scheduled to be in action next at 1 p.m. on Saturday against Southwestern Community College. The main attraction screenplay for this week. Don't forget that Ohio State and Oregon, this week's best game resides in the Heartland. College football playoffs hopes are on the line for the first time in the series. As crazy as it sounds, in fact, this is the first Cy-Hawk series meeting in which both teams enter ranked. Iowa State coach Matt Campbell is more popular than the mayor in Ames, but he has yet to beat the rival Hawkeyes 0-4. So number 10, Iowa, at number 9, Iowa State, and 3 p.m. on ABC. And that brings us to the end of today's reading for the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for September 10th. And the Nonpareil can be heard each weekday at 3 p.m. Iris volunteers love to hear from listeners. So if you have any comments or questions about today's broadcast or any Iris program, please call toll-free from anywhere in Iowa at 877-404-4747. And I am Kylie Kaler from Drake University in Des Moines. And thank you so much for listening. Have a great day. We'll be right back.
From the Bureau of Economic Geology, this is Earth Date. Whales and dolphins are spectacular creatures. Their ancestors climbed out of the ocean 360 million years ago, developed lungs and legs, and evolved into mammals. Then, 50 million years ago, they walked back into the sea. To survive there, they developed specialized behaviors, which require even more special biology. Perhaps most famous is echolocation. They move air between sinus cavities to emit sound. When it bounces back to them, they don't hear it with their ears, but feel it in a fatty fluid in their lower jaw. Only toothed whales, like sperm whales, orcas, and dolphins, can echolocate, which we think they developed to hunt prey, especially squid, in the darkness of the deep ocean. Baleen whales focused on other prey, floating shrimp-like creatures, and for this they develop comb-like plates in place of teeth. They can't echolocate, but are known for their elaborate songs. We think they use these for communication, but we're not sure how they produce them, since they don't have vocal cords. Both types of whales can hold their breath for 45 minutes or longer. To do this, they reduce their heart rate and cut blood flow to some organs, like the stomach, while providing it to others, like the brain. Even their blood is specialized. It can carry far more oxygen than land-dwelling mammals, and they have much more of it. Whales are an amazing example of what evolution can do, given enough time. I'm Scott Tinker, spouting off on Earth Date.
Earth Date is produced by the Bureau of Economic Geology at the University of Texas at Austin, with support from Schlumberger, helping oil and gas companies increase production and efficiency while lowering environmental impact. You can hear more Earth Date stories at earthdate.org.